We'd love for everyone to be able to open a Bible this morning to Ecclesiastes chapter 2 as we look at and consider and receive verses 1 through 11. So we read in Ecclesiastes 2:1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. This is the word of the Lord. When I was growing up, if you referred to someone as a goat or the goat, it basically meant the person was a bum, a loser, somebody that had disappointed you, somebody that you just were not very pleased with. But now, in our culture today, when you call someone the goat, it means that someone is the greatest of all time. G-O-A-T, greatest of all time, the GOAT. Make sense? Clear as mud, right? So many would say Tom Hanks is the GOAT of male actors. Most would say Tom Brady is the GOAT of pro football players, the greatest of all time. Like him or not, he's won 7 Super Bowls. It's astounding. It's incredible to think Tom Brady personally has more success than virtually every other NFL franchise. It's hard to really understand the significance of it and see what an incredible accomplishment it is to have won now 7 Super Bowls. So then you'd think the GOAT, if anybody, would also be satisfied sensing a settled peace about fulfillment in his life. You may or may not know he's very rich. You win 7 Super Bowls, you're going to be very rich. You may or may not know he's married to a supermodel. And what both of those have brought is incredible experiences and fame and all sorts of pleasures that you and I probably at some point had only imagined what it would be like to experience. And he's walked that path. So then you would think, the guy has peace, the guy is satisfied. Back in 2005, when he had only won 3, okay? 2005, so 16 years ago, Tom Brady said this, why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me, I think... He went to Michigan, so excuse his grammar here. It's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be. And in that interview, the gentleman that was interviewing him said, then Tom, what's the answer? Quote, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Did winning 4 more Super Bowls satisfy this man? No. Just this past week in a separate interview, someone asked him about the 2007 season where they went undefeated all the way until the Super Bowl. They lost the very last game. They said, so then what would you trade to get that accomplishment? He said, I'd trade 2 of my Super Bowl rings. if I could go back and have completed the perfect season of 2007. In other words, Tom Brady, with all of his wealth and all of his success, to lean on that great rock and roll band U2, he still hasn't found what he's looking for. And he's accomplished what so many are hoping to accomplish. So many are envious of this man. And he sits there as the accomplished one, empty, uncertain. You see, King Solomon told us all those years ago, we can have all the wealth, we can have all the pleasure in the world and gain nothing. We can have all the wealth, all the pleasure, but still gain nothing. So then, instead of thinking about or reading or watching an interview with some modern-day celebrity, let's now turn our attention to this conversation that King Solomon, in some manner, is having with himself. And he invites us in to overhear this internal conversation just for a moment. So as he's preaching to this gathered audience, he's now reflecting on a moment, an aha moment that he had in his heart and in his mind. And it's important that we remember this. He had more knowledge, he had more wisdom, he had more wealth than anyone before him and all that would come after him except for Jesus. And that enabled him to set out on this curious grand research project of discovering the meaning, the purpose, the fulfillment of life. And he applied that superior knowledge, that superior intellect, into understanding mysteries of life. And what did it give him? Where did that pursuit of understanding the mysteries of life lead him? He told us in 1:18, vexation, sorrow. It did not give him fulfillment. It did not give him joy. It did not give him satisfaction. Vexation and sorrow. All of that hard work, sorrow. What would you do? All of that hard work and it led to a dead end. Maybe stale water instead of fresh water. What would you do? Many of us would give up and say, I gave it my best effort. I came up empty. I quit. We do that with friendships. We do that with marriage. We do that. We've even done it with our own children at times. We've done it with one another. We've done it with a diet and exercise. We've done it in so many areas. I gave it my best. I came up short. I quit. But not Solomon. Look at verse 1. I said in my heart, come now. So he's talking to himself. Come now. I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. So if philosophical pursuit in understanding the mysteries of God and the mysteries of life wouldn't satisfy, let's go towards amusement. And he decided to test himself. He needed to experiment and get hands-on learning. And what he wanted to experiment with was various vast forms of pleasure, literally joy, gladness. Come now, I will test you with pleasure, with joy, with gladness. So therefore, enjoy yourself. And this word pleasure here is a word that's also used in the Bible to describe our worship of and our relationship with God, such as what Emily read there in Psalm 100, serve the Lord with gladness, with pleasure, with joy. So this is not something that, this pursuit of pleasure that we want to, pardon my English, poo-poo too quickly. This is not something we want to cast out and say, well, that was his problem. He decided to pursue pleasure. No, no, no. All through the scriptures, the Lord commands us to pursue pleasure. He told us to serve him with pleasure. So hear me. Hear me on this. God is not anti-pleasure. I think I said this last week. I think I've said it many times now. God is not a killjoy. God is passionately about killing everything that is not producing lasting joy. He's not a killjoy. He's killing that which steals joy. And that's why we have the Bible. What a gracious act of God to open up his heart and speak to us and to describe that broad path that leads to destruction. It's so inviting, isn't it? There's so many charms on it. It's so glittery, shiny, compelling. And he says, you see that way that so many are on? It'll ruin you. But you see this way over here that so many are rejecting? It'll satisfy you. And we stand daily at that crossroads of those two intersect or those two roads, and we say, yeah, I believe, but help my unbelief. And we begin to move towards that broad way that leads to destruction here. We forget that God's not killing joy. He's giving us permission to pursue without shame that which is joy, lasting, eternal joy. So then, as we look now to Solomon's words, it is my heart's desire on behalf of Jesus that we all have a humble heart, that we all receive the word of the Lord today, listening to the Spirit of the Lord, letting Him speak into all areas of our heart and of our life, and that we say right now, before we walk through this, yes, Lord, whatever You've said to me, I will put into practice today. Regardless of whether it's new or not, regardless of whether it cuts against us or not, I will receive the word of the Lord today in practice because You know better than I do. And I know You're not out to ruin me, You're out to rescue me. So I'm ready to receive Your word. Now, one of the commentaries that I looked at this week described these verses 2, 1 through 11 using the image of a house or Solomon's palace. And he titled this section, The Hollow House of Hedonism. You'd think he's a Baptist with all the H's there. The Hollow House of Hedonism. And I like how this particular writer took the reader on a journey through Solomon's, well, hollow house. And the reason I bring it up is he described four rooms. Solomon invites us into four rooms. And I like the imagery there, so I'm just going to lean on it. I'm not saying exactly all that he said. I'm not even saying close to what he said in some manner. But I like these four categories, these four rooms that he's inviting us into in this moment. I want to say again, before we walk into these rooms, we can have all the wealth, we can have all the pleasure in the world, but gain nothing, okay? And the first room we're going to walk into is the private pub. And we'll see the pleasure of the private pub, verses 2 and 3 of Ecclesiastes 2. Solomon said, I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me in wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Not all laughter is madness, right? Not all pleasure is, quote, no use. But as solutions to the pain and the sorrow and the grief of living in this world, laughter is not resolution. We know from personal experience, either our own or someone we know, laughter is oftentimes a mask, a concealer, at least we think so, of depression. I remember going to see a doctor one time, and as I was sitting there waiting for him to come in and check me out, it's when it occurred to me, I don't even know what to say to this man for why I'm physically off. Like, I can't even describe. So he walked in, and he said, so Eric, how's it going? And I laughed. And he pulled that stool a little bit closer, and he asked me a few more questions. And then he chuckled, and he said, Eric, I just think you're depressed right now. Like, I laughed at it. And it was the first time it occurred to me I was coping with some terrible things by laughing. But I wasn't fixing anything. I wasn't actually addressing any heart sorrow. I was laughing it off. And so that's what Solomon is saying right here. If we think laughter, if we think pleasure is going to resolve some of the conflicts of this world, some of the griefs that we're still carrying with us, we need to realize it's madness. It's no use. He said in verse 1, behold, this also is vanity. He said in verse 11, behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind. How many of you remember that TV comedy from the 80s and maybe into the 90s called Cheers? Anybody remember that? Man, didn't it make hanging out with those guys so inviting? The whole idea of going into this little pub there in Boston, this bar in Boston, and where everybody knows your name, didn't it make just checking in on a Tuesday afternoon to have a beer with what was it, Sam and Diane and Woody and Coach and Frazier, didn't it make it so inviting? Norm, right? See, our culture puts wine and spirits together, doesn't it? It puts laughter or cheer and alcohol together. Look at verse 3. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. So Solomon is saying, cheers. I want to know the experience that Mayday Malone had, or Norm had, or whomever, as they walked into that bar. I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. I want to read this next phrase, okay? And I want you to hear me when I say this. This word about wisdom, he is saying, and I wasn't a drunken fool. I drank with control. I consumed alcohol in moderation. Okay, that's what he's saying right here. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. I was not out of control. Moderation is what he was saying right here, okay? So what we just did is maybe we would say we took all drunken, ridiculous behavior because of alcohol and put it off to the side here to say, let's collectively agree that is sinful against God. It is harmful to us. That's not what we're talking about, though. He's talking about all the rest of the types of drinking. That is the type of person that would say, I just need a beer today. What do we mean when we say, I just need a beer today? I assume we don't mean I need to become a drunken fool and injure myself. I need to be a drunken fool and injure those around me. I need to go drown all my sorrows in this alcohol. I assume that's not what we mean. I assume we mean something far more innocent than anything remotely close to that. I think what we mean is, I just want to sit down, kick my shoes off, enjoy a tasty beer, and relax. At least I assume that's what you mean when you say that. Is it fair for me to assume that? What do you mean when you say, I just need a beer today? I think we mean, just need to relax. In ways that we don't normally think about. In ways that we're not consciously aware of. We believe subtly that that alcoholic drink will somehow benefit us today. It'll take the edge off. It'll cause us to relax. It'll bring a degree of peace or joy or completion to our day. All we're looking for is some measure. Are you ready? Oh, that's what we think. That's what we strive for. Because we still mean sincerely, when we do that, we will, quote, be guided with wisdom. Right? Right? That seems to be what Solomon's saying. It seems to be the conversation he's having with himself, and he's now inviting us in to see how this thing begins to play out. Do you see in the Word of God what I'm seeing here? You see, I'm not spinning this. I'm not assuming anything. I'm just taking this revelation here. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Solomon was wondering, curious, if wine could somehow cheer him and help him deal with the brevity of life, with the harshness of life. He says right here, could this alcohol somehow take the edge off the harsh reality of the few years, few days of life under the sun? That is, will wine help me relax and enjoy my life? Isn't that what we're saying? At the end of a hard day, we just need to go out and have some beer, Scott. Will it somehow help us just relax and enjoy our life in a way that the hard day, the reality of life, did not allow us to do? Now, if you're uncomfortable, welcome to Ecclesiastes 2. Brothers and sisters, I have carried this in my heart all week. My job, as much as I want to be friends, oh goodness, as much as I want you to like me, affirm me, my job is not first to affirm. My job is not first to encourage. It is certainly not first to be your friend. The whole reason I'm here is to say what the Lord has said, okay? And I'm just trying to be faithful to what the Bible says right here, this inspired word of the Lord. So what does the Bible say about cheering our bodies with wine while still having self-control, while still having wisdom in our mind? What does the Bible say about that activity? What use is it? What use is it? Brother, sister, and I wish I could have this conversation one-on-one with every single one of us, just asking from the Scriptures, what use is it? Even when wisdom remains and guides us in cheering our bodies with wine, Solomon, led by the Holy Spirit, concluded there was nothing to be gained in it. There was nothing to be gained, but there's so much to be lost. I'm confident of this. Are you ready? If we knew the harm, the injury, just in this room, if we knew the harm, the injury carried in our hearts because of alcohol, none of us would ever go near it again. It would never just be a casual thing. We have so, just in this room, we have our brothers and sisters, our own body, that have been profoundly hurt because of consuming alcohol. And I don't just mean physical abuse. Probably, more likely, it's been neglect. Someone seeking to just consume a little alcohol in time, unintentionally, was consumed by it. And if they didn't raise their hand and smack their children or smack their spouse, they were just absent. They had checked out in a drunken stupor. It had dulled their sensibilities, and they just didn't care that had they not been affected by alcohol, they would have cared. And so the hurt in this room is enough for us to say, this is an entirely different conversation. This is no longer... See, what we think, hear me on this, what we think is the innocent, me and God in the privacy of my home enjoying an afternoon beer is so much more than that. Because Solomon is saying this to us. The pub was open every day and empty every day. We thought it would bring wine and spirits. It brought wine and emptiness. We thought it would help us deal with the harsh realities of fallen world, just take the edge off a little bit. But every morning when we woke up, that harsh reality was there. So he invites us into the private pub, saying, I sought pleasure there, but there's nothing to be gained in that room. So then he walks us out and closes that door behind, and he's saying to us, do you believe me? Do you believe me? We all need to answer that. Do we believe what he said right there? And then he takes us outside, maybe, into his garden. This, come behold all the pleasure that I sought in the garden. His personal creative space, and brothers and sisters, friends, it was spectacular. It's as if he tried to recreate the Garden of Eden. And so he walks us through it. Look at verses 4 through 7. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves. Also slaves were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. Welcome to the gospel of self-indulgence. He thought, if I just pursue all of these pleasures that I have in my heart, maybe that will satisfy me. Have you caught on in this section in particular, but even in Ecclesiastes as a whole, have you caught on to just how self-centered Solomon was? Did you notice how many times, and what we read just this morning, how many times he said, I, me, myself, or my? Are you ready? 38 times. 38 times. He said that in just these verses here. I said last week what I need to say again. Using God's gifts to find meaning in life, and meaning, purpose, significance, fulfillment, using God's gifts to find meaning in life apart from God only produces sorrow because it's sin. So you can build yourself all the gardens in the world for yourself, and it will only bring sorrow. You can put a new wall around your backyard and repurpose it so that you can have your own little private kingdom. Leave me alone. I mean, my goodness, it's called a privacy fence for a reason. You can put a gate around your whole community. It only produces sorrow. When you use God's gifts for your own self-interest. That's what Solomon is saying here. So Solomon did He confesses here, he did all that Adam was to do. He planted, he gardened, he watered, he made, he explored and harvested all kinds of trees. He did what Adam was created to do, and it turns out, like Adam, he did it for himself. So he said, I made great works. He said, I made houses. I built houses. Now, just as a note, it took Solomon hiring all these people, farming out all this work. It took 7 years to build the temple of God, God's house. 7 years. It took 13 years to build Solomon's house. And 1 Kings 10 tells us about the other houses that he had and the other towns that he built. And I think we should read that and think, my goodness, man, it sounds like you have misplaced priorities. God only gets 7 years, which is incredible. It took 7 years, but you got 13 years. So he's bragging here. I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and parks. I planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools. He is a proud, accomplished, self-made man. After all, he worked so hard. What? He worked so hard. Might as well enjoy it. Isn't that how we live? Isn't that what we think? Isn't that what we hear others saying? Isn't that what we laugh at? Isn't that what we encourage from time to time? Man, you worked so hard. Why don't you now enjoy all the fruit of your labors? Isn't that why people move to this area? Because they've worked so hard. They've been so disciplined. They saved. They've invested. They've been responsible. Now they had the financial means to not work another day in their life. Let's move here and play golf. Let's move here and buy more quads or whatever it may be. Solomon walks us out of his house to look at all his accomplishments, thinking, I worked, I earned it, I will enjoy it. And he says, what use is it? And we argue back, but you haven't seen my kitchen, Solomon. I've got to remodel my kitchen. You haven't seen my backyard. I need to refresh my backyard. Dog tore up the last round of sod. I got to get fresh sod. Then, you haven't seen my old quad. I need a new one. Solomon, you're not aware that I have to Airbnb when I need to get out of this heat and go up north. I need to buy a cabin. And we just go on and on and on, and we think that next thing, then I will have peace. And Solomon says, really? Let me tell you about that. Look at all that I accomplished in this world. You want to lay out resumes? You want to lay out experiences? Fine. Let's compare. I will always have outdone you. What use is it? So when he looks out across his garden, he says, nope, nothing to be gained there. Let's go back inside. And we're left with that question, do we believe Solomon? Do we believe Solomon today? And so when he takes us back in, maybe the thing, this is where we see the bling, the shine, the gold. He invites us into the treasury. So he says in verse 7, I bought, now he's bragging about his wealth, and this is horrific. I bought male and female slaves. Oh my goodness. I bought male and female slaves. And he had so many slaves for so long, he had slaves who were born in his house. And he says, I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I want you to make a note, and this week read 1 Kings 10 and 11. And in particular, I want you to notice how many times it mentions gold. It's crazy how much gold Solomon had and what he made out of gold. It says this about Solomon and his wealth. Solomon made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. Why can't I get my brain around that? He made silver as common as stone. This is how wealthy this man was. Solomon was the type of man that he had more wealth than time, energy, creativity could spend. It's like Solomon had so much wealth that he could live 10 lives and not spend it all. And don't we sometimes wonder, man, what would that be like? To have more money than time, energy, and creativity could spend? Well, I'd like to try that for a week. And sometimes, I'll admit, it's fun. Like, what would you do if you won the Powerball? I'd buy a baseball team. I don't know. I'd probably knock out these walls and do something else here. I don't know. But isn't that fun just to imagine? Money is no limit. That's where Solomon was. He never denied himself because he didn't have the resources to provide for himself. Money was never an issue. One author said, quote, "Gold is cold. Gold is cold. It cannot touch you or embrace you." And we know that, don't we? Solomon knew it. And so he's taking us now out of the treasury into the bedroom where he could touch and be touched. God have mercy on us as we read this, as we see pleasure in the bedroom. Silver, as common as stones, is not as hard to fathom as what we're going to read here. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. He hired personal, private performers for his bedroom. This is also sad. This is also empty. For when you read 1 Kings 11, you'll be reminded Solomon had 700 wives. 700 wives. 300 concubines. 300 women that existed for his physical pleasure. Solomon was always partaking, but Solomon was never full. He was always partaking, always empty, always craving and taking more. This is sad. You think about the guy, or perhaps the girl, that just binge watches pornography for hours on end on the internet. That's sad. And they know that it's sad, but the hooks are in them and they just can't shake them loose. Solomon didn't have the internet. He had women. And so you got to know anything outside of God's good design of one man and one woman in the safe, lasting intimacy of marriage. Because it's not righteousness, anything outside of that, because it's not righteousness, only produces sorrow. So Solomon's not strutting around as this proud, accomplished man. Solomon is limping around as one devastated by sin when he says this. But think about those women. Think of the heart sorrow of these women, even if they were paid royally by this king to come in and physically entertain him and physically satisfy him. Think about the emptiness that they carried in their heart as they were used for such wickedness. And they look out, and maybe they knew, maybe they were aware of 299 others or 700 wives. Maybe they weren't. But what they knew was not safety, was not covenant faithfulness. Think about their understanding of God in that moment. If the king of God's people will use me until he's satisfied and then remove me, what must his God be like? You wonder why the world doesn't love Jesus? Could it be because, like Solomon, we've been proclaiming a lie about our Lord? Jesus is faithful. He's loyal. He protects. He provides. He's strong. He cares. But I assume because of whether it is physical immorality or digital immorality or just television streaming devices, like Solomon, God will keep you around to the degree that you offer some benefit. And when that benefit is gone, you may go now. That's blasphemy. Solomon was a liar. And rather than being formed into the image of Christ, many of us are still formed in Solomon's image. And we're just using people for our own wicked pleasure. So my heart aches as I ask, brothers, sisters, are we listening to Solomon this morning? Are we listening to the wisdom God gave this man in the later years of his life? Are we humble enough to receive what he says to us? There's nothing to be gained in these vain pursuits of pleasure. Will we receive the word of the Lord? Read with me verse 9. He says, "I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem." And he says it a second time now. "Also, my wisdom remained with me." He's practicing moderation by his definition. You come to Solomon and say, "Don't be excessive." He's like, "What are you talking about? Of course I'm not. I had wisdom." You think that's excessive? No. That was self-control. Listen to this next astounding phrase. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Could you imagine such living? Your neighbor rolls up with a new car. You look at it and desire it, and you go, I'll get one. Or you scroll through social media, and they buy the new house, and you think, I want that. I'll go do it. You just hear about the new street taco truck down the road, and you go, oh, I want that. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. He never denied himself. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this vain, worthless, momentary, empty experience, this was my reward. You can tell he's not celebrating all of his accomplishments here. He's not saying, come on in, the water's fine. He says, do not go there. It's dreadful. This was my reward for all of my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended to do it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Did you notice the verbal bookends of this passage here in 1 and 11? It is the word, behold, and it is emphatic. And wise Grandpa Solomon, with all of the worldly travel, worldly experiences, all of these pleasures that he has embraced, emphatically says, behold, stop. Look at me. Listen to me. Receive what I'm saying to you today about this pursuit of pleasure. Behold, this also was vanity. Behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. The reward for all of his pursuit of pleasure was gone just as soon as he grabbed a hold of it. It's kind of like grasping the wind. It's gone. That was his reward, and it left him empty. So we say we can have all the wealth, all the pleasure in the world, and gain nothing. Well, today's Mother's Day, and happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. About the best gift you can give your mom today is to receive the word of the Lord. Is to not kick against the wisdom of God, but to humbly sit and experience fullness of life as you're conformed to the image of a son. As I said, Solomon lived a life of being a false witness about the Lord. He said to the world through his life, God is selfish. God keeps. God makes for himself. God takes. And when he's tired of taking, he kicks. Solomon used his freedom on himself, not on God. Solomon used his freedom for himself, but never Jesus. You know, Jesus was faced with every temptation, and he had the opportunity to pursue every pleasure. But Jesus never looked to his own interest. He looked for your interest. He looked for our interest. He did what he did for us. And so then what we're getting our minds around right now is Jesus not only practiced moderation, he abstained from every weight and sin. Not just every sin, but every weight and every sin. He abstained from all of that, and he ran with endurance the race that is set before him, looking to, living for the greater lasting pleasure of doing the Father's will. And the Father's will was that none of his children will perish. So we're here today because Jesus not only practiced moderation, but he abstained. He denied himself. He was rich, but for our sake, he became poor. Never claimed the right to do anything. Never claimed the freedom. Instead, our Lord denied himself for you and me. And so if we know him, having repented of sin, having trusted in him, confessing him, you are my Lord now. I'm no longer my Lord. You are my Lord. If we know him, let's follow him. Let's never bow up. Let's never swell up with pride and say, well, I have the freedom to do that. I have the right to do that. Hear me on this. That's about the most immature Christian argument out there. I have the freedom to do this, so I will. The mature argument would be, I have the freedom to do it, but I won't for your sake. Because that's what our Lord did. And so if we do know Him, let's follow Him on that road of denying ourselves. Because we know He is the one that gives eternal pleasure. In His presence, there is fullness of joy. And at His right hand are pleasures forevermore. The Lord's not killing our joy. He's setting us free from everything that's stealing our joy, everything that's promising us joy but leaving us empty. And His Word, Ecclesiastes, is a grace because He's rescuing us from a life of vain pursuit, looking for pleasure in places that never satisfy. Let's fix our eyes on Jesus. Let's follow Him.